I just go back and remind of the last couple of weeks what we've been looking at as we started through chapter 2. It talks in the first three verses about the false teachers, that there just as there were false prophets in the Old Testament that led the people astray, in the New Testament there are false teachers, even in Peter's day, that would lead the people astray. And then he goes on to give three illustrations that show that God judges those who do wickedly, those who would lead the people astray, at the same time being able to rescue. And verse 9 is sort of the summary. Then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from trials and keep the unrighteous under punishment until the day of judgment. So we're ready with that then to look at verses 10 to 16 in 2 Peter 2. And talk about being kept for the day of judgment. And especially those who indulge the flesh of defiling passion, the lust of defiling passion, and despise authority. Bold and willful, they do not tremble as they blaspheme the glorious ones. Whereas angels, though greater in might and power, do not pronounce a blasphemous judgment against them before the Lord. But these, like irrational animals, creatures of instinct, born to be caught and destroyed, blaspheming about matters of which they are ignorant, will also be destroyed in their destruction, suffering wrong as the wage for their wrongdoing. They count it pleasure to revel in the daytime. They are blots and blemishes, reveling in their deceptions while they feast with you. They have eyes full of adultery, insatiable for sin. They entice unsteady souls. They have hearts trained in greed. Accursed children, forsaking the right way, they have gone astray. They have followed the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved gain for wrongdoing, but was rebuked for his own transgression. A speechless donkey spoke with human voice and restrained the prophet's madness. Well, there's a sermon outline in the bulletin. Depending upon which statistics you look at, mainland China has surpassed the United States as the number one economic power in the world. Or if you look at some other statistics, say that they will shortly be passing us as the world leader in terms of economies. Some people maybe find that surprising, but if you've ever been to mainland China and visit there, it's very clear that the economy is growing. You know, take a walk in any major city, and what do you see in the skyline? You see these construction cranes all over the place. The new buildings going up all over. You might compare that to walking down through Detroit, and what do you see? You see a city that looks like it's been in a war zone. The buildings are falling apart. Buildings abandoned. Buildings have been burned out. You find city blocks where there's only one, maybe, house. And all the rest are vacant lots. It's a city very much in trouble. And there's a reason why it has gone through bankruptcy. Very striking would be the contrast. And yet, if you look at the Chinese economy, there are things that are a problem. One is the issue of copyright infringement. If you buy a CD, a movie over there, it's not likely that you'll get the genuine article. What you'll get is somebody who purchased one and made copies, and then maybe somebody else and pot a copy and makes copy, and so you're getting a copy of a copy. And it doesn't show as well. or does it sound as good as what the original are? Similarly, their products that are counterfeit, they maybe have the right name on them, but they aren't. And you can find a place where, you know, you go into the grocery store and they'll say Sunkissed on the orange. But you know it's not a Sunkissed orange. The company would never allow an orange that small and that bad to be put under their label. And I recall talking to a farmer in northeast China. And supposedly as they went to the farm store to buy their seed, they were getting hybrid seed from the United States. And they found, well, the first year was great. And they got great harvests. But after that, he could tell it wasn't genuine seed. He said he'd be willing to pay 4 or 5 times more than what they're charging if he could just get genuine seed like that first year. Because what happens? They go and get the seed that's supposed to be good seed, and they plant it, and virtually nothing comes up. And what comes up doesn't yield a very big crop. And the crop isn't very good. And for a farmer who depends upon that crop, it's devastating. And to have it do it several years in a row puts them on the brink of famine, of starving. And many, for that reason, go into the city to work where they're guaranteed some wages. And so we have in China this problem of something that says it's the real thing, but it isn't. And the consequences are disastrous because it isn't a genuine article. Well, the same thing is true here as we look at Christianity. There are those who say that they're the genuine article, that they're speaking on behalf of God. They have great insight, maybe even superior insight into what God is and what he wants from us. But as the apostle points out, they are not. They're false teachers who actually lead people away from God. And so their claims of having superior knowledge are false. And the results of those who listen to them are disastrous if you fall after what they say. And so we're looking at three things in these verses. First is the character of these false teachers. Second is the danger they pose to believers. And third is the outcome to the false teachers. First is the character of these false teachers. And there's three things that we can notice. First, as you look at verses 10 to 12, is they despise authority. It starts with their arrogance. They're bold and willful, we see in verse 11. They're proud of how much they know, how much spiritual wisdom and understanding they think they have. Their spiritual maturity. They have a confidence they know and they speak on behalf of God, when in truth they're blaspheming God and speaking against God. And it says they do not hesitate to blaspheme against the glorious ones. Now, there's some question as who is this glorious ones that Peter's referring to. Is it the angels that are mentioned next and have been mentioned previously? Is it somehow the leaders of the church? Or maybe the apostles in more particular? Or some others? But what is, when we can't be certain, but what's important is their attitude. That there's an attitude of pride and of slandering, of speaking down, of viewing others with the wrong attitude. And the contrast is with the angels who are superior. They're greater in power and might. And this is an argument from the lesser to the greater. If the greater doesn't do this, Why should anyone who's lesser than the angels are so cognizant that they're before God that they don't speak evil, don't slander in this way? And the point is, how much more should they who are lesser not speak evil of somebody? And notice it's before the Lord. The angels actually stand before them. They're aware of the very presence of God with them. And we may not be quite as aware of the presence of God with us, but we are never hidden from God's sight. He sees and hears all that we do. And that's something that we should keep in mind. To remember the next time we're tempted to say something contemptuous of another person. We should be maybe asking ourselves, do we really know the person's motives? Or cause them to say this or to do that? Because often we impugn motives and ascribe bad things to somebody else. You know, we've just gone through the political season. And what have you seen on TV? Well, you've seen a lot of ads that question a person's motives, that questions why they do these things, and gives all sorts of judgments against them. God desires that we not do that. And in the case of these false teachers, they're slandering, they're blaspheming, we're told, about matters of which they're ignorant. Things that they don't know. And how often do we do that same thing when we don't know a person's heart or their motivation? Do we treat them in the wrong way? Well, there's much that's beyond our human understanding, and that's especially true in the spiritual realm. It's the height of arrogance to think that I have all the answers. Especially, I know more than the apostles who are eyewitnesses of Christ, who lived with Him, talked with Him, saw all that He did. But that same process of questioning is still going on today. One prime example is at the end of this section that we read, where it talks about Balaam's donkey. Because people will question and they'll say, you know, those who are teachers, Christian teachers, can a donkey really speak? Does a donkey have the right capacity to process words and to get them out? You know, does he have the vocal cords that could actually make those sounds? It's a fairy tale. And we need to reject it. They make bold assertions about what can and can't be true in Scripture. And someone else will say, well, Jesus never said a single word against homosexuality. And they'll claim that, and you hear it all over the place. But is that really true? When Jesus said that marriage from the beginning is one man to one woman, wasn't He coming out against homosexual marriage? Isn't being narrow-minded. And it isn't being bigotry, it's being true to what Jesus says. And today, the pride of men will say, I know better than to think a donkey could speak, or that Jesus would ever condemn homosexuality. But there are matters of which they're ignorant. And so we see them despising authority. Second thing is they disregard holiness. And there are three things that are principally mentioned here in these verses. First, in verse 13, is they count it pleasure to revel in the daytime. Now, that word pleasure is the word from which we get hedonism in the English. That self-centered pursuit of pleasure. These false teachers are so given over to pleasure that they revel in the daytime. Think about that phrase. Reveling in the daytime. Now, what do you think about somebody who's reveling all the time, who is reveling? You know, getting drunk, partying, every day, all day long. If you go back to the first centuries, the Jews condemned reveling during the daytime, the Christians condemned it, the Greeks and the Romans, and virtually everybody condemns reveling in the daytime. The daytime is when we're to be working. And to revel is to be disregarding work. It's a sign of decadence. It's a loss of your moral way on the most basic of issues. You know, without work, none of us is able to survive. You know, how do we get food and clothing and shelter? Well, it's through work. That we receive these things, that we have these things. And it's sad when an ethics of playing, of revelry, of having fun, of seeking self-pleasure replaces an ethic of work. And especially in the first century, we didn't have storehouses full of food. You know, one bad harvest was bad on you. A lack of work would bring you into great poverty and great distress. And so, they give themselves over to pleasure. And pleasure all the time when they should be working. Second, is they have a disregard for holiness. Verse 14 says they have eyes full of adultery, insatiable for sin. And literally it says they have eyes full of the adulterous woman. And what it's saying is such ones are looking at every single person as a potential partner. As someone that they would desire to commit adultery with. Their eyes are filled with adultery. And then it goes on to say, and they're never satisfied. Literally, they never cease to sin. There's never enough. There's always longing for more. There's a restlessness in their sin. Their lives are being dominated by these sinful desires that grow stronger and stronger. Their passions are becoming stronger in them. And too often you can look around and see, you know, the alcoholic just gets more and more tied into alcohol or the drug addict or the one caught up in pornography. They're never satisfied. They always want more. Thirdly, in verse 14, they have hearts that are trained in greed. You saw that a couple of weeks ago, but they're greedy. And that word trained is, in English, we get the word gymnasium from it. And you think about, you know, what you do when you go to the gymnasium, just as the ancient Greeks did, as they would go to the gymnasium, they want to be trained, they want to train their body to do certain things, to perform a certain way, to create what they call muscle memory, you know, to build endurance, to build skills. Well, they're doing all these things in terms of greed. They're learning more about greed and how to exercise their greed. How to be good at wanting more and gaining more. And it saddened me a while ago when probably one of the richest TV pastors, came out with a new program, a new monthly service. And for a certain month, amount each month, you could be part of this inner circle that receives certain messages from him and all the rest. And I'm sure thousands or tens of thousands of people signed up. It's a huge amount of cash flowing in. A new way of receiving money. And why is it all necessary? I know from the sales of his books, he's very wealthy. He doesn't need all this. Why this greediness, this wanting of more and more and more? But as you look at these things, the reveling in the daytime, the eyes full of adultery, greed, these are things that are the opposite of holiness, that destroy true holiness. And the third characteristics of these false teachers as they depart from the right way, as you look at verse 16. 15 rather. 15, they forsake the right way, they've gone astray. And the image is from the Old Testament where the way to God, the way of obedience, is like a road that led to God. And these are deliberately turning their backs on that road, saying, I'm not going to travel down that road. I'm going to go in the opposite direction. They know the right road. They know who it is that they're to believe in and what they're to do, how they're to live, but they don't want to follow that path. That path that's narrow, that says you must die to self and you must live in the newness of life. You must live in the heavenly places with Christ who's raised you from the dead. And by going astray in this way, they're turning their backs on God. They're rejecting the idea that Jesus Christ is the way to God. And there are many that do that today. How many times have you heard that all roads lead to God? As if it doesn't matter who Jesus Christ is and what he did. Or all religions are equally valid. An example of this deliberately turning away from the truth is in the Old Testament prophet of Balaam. Now he did receive prophetic words, but he turned away. There's a king named Balak, if you read the scriptures, that wanted him to come and to look over the people of Israel and curse them. And he offers to pay him a tremendous amount of money. And this is what sways him to go and to saddle, get on his donkey and go to curse God's people. And you may remember that the donkey would not go. And so he beat the donkey and the donkey speaks to him. Why are you doing this? And then he's shown that the angel that was there in the way that was going to slay him. And God tells him, you can go, but you may not curse my people. And goes. And he doesn't curse the people. He tells the king that he can't do it. But that's not the end of the story. He does come up with some counsel. There's a way to bring down those people of God, and that's to get them to intermarry, to worship foreign gods, to get them involved in immorality, and that will bring them down. And they listen, and the people of Israel sin against God and do those things. but he's a prototype of a prophet who sells off, who's not concerned about God and his word, but is concerned for himself, for accumulating much, and will advise wickedness, counsel immorality, and rejecting God. For the second point, just briefly, we see the danger the false teachers are opposed to believers in verse 14. They entice unsteady souls. These false teachers do have an effect. There are those who are immature, who are unsteady in their faith, who are young in their faith, who have not seen maturity built into their lives, and are able to be led astray, to be taken away from the truth, be taken away from holiness, to be led away from a relationship to God. Now that word entice would be a word that Peter would be very familiar. It's really a fishing term of a lure, of something in the water that would attract the fish. And just as the fish is in trouble if he's enticed by that piece of bait in the water and goes, grabs on, so too an unstable soul is in trouble if they're enticed by that false teaching that sounds good. This sounds great when they're saying, well, Christ has set you free. You're free to do anything you want. How marvelous is that? Well, if you take that bait, it's disastrous, just as it is for the fish. And so we need to see that the false teachers have great destructive power to those who are unstable, to those who are not mature in their faith. And the fourth point is the outcome of the false teachers and to those who would listen to them. It's destruction. Did you notice the number of times destruction was mentioned in their wrongdoing? They're going to receive the wages, they're going to suffer destruction, they're destroyed in their destruction. Phrase upon phrase heaped to get the point that they're facing utter destruction. In verse 12, it's compared to an irrational animal, a creature of insect, of instinct, is born to be caught and destroyed. And the fact that they're not pursuing anything higher, just living very carnally in this life, they're like a farm animal. What happens to that farm animal? It's born and raised to a certain point, and at some point, the animal is caught and taken to the slaughterhouse. Very graphic. Saying that these ones are destined to be destroyed. In verse 14, secondly, it talks about them being accursed children. And literally, it's the children of the curse. Now, there's a Hebrew idiom, son of or children of, that means a person characterized by. And so Barnabas is a son of encouragement. He's a person who encourages others. Well, these are children of the curse. They're characterized by falling under the curse of God. God's curse rests upon them. And the ESV that I read from has an exclamation point after this. But I don't think it should really be an exclamation point, because there's no delight. There's just a simple statement of fact that these are characterized as being under a curse. All who are not covered by the blood of Christ, by His death, remain under a curse. It's only by faith in Jesus Christ that that curse is taken away. Finally, we can ask what happened to Balaam. As we read his story, you know, what happens to him? He tells the, you know, gives the king some good advice as to how to bring the people down. You can't separate them from their God by a curse, but you can by getting them to behave improperly. What does he do? Does he go back home after he does this? Well, no, he actually goes and settles with the people on the land of Canaan. And it's recorded in Joshua that he is one of the ones who died when the land was conquered. Think of that. He chose, even though he'd been warned, even though the donkey had spoken to him, he chose to live with those who are headed for destruction. It's really the ultimate in foolishness. It talks in terms of the prophet's madness. Well, this is complete madness. When you know God's people are blessed to go and live with those who aren't. To be destroyed when they are destroyed. He chose the path that led to his own destruction. Just as those who follow the false teachers choose the path that will lead to their own destruction. The way of life is to listen to the message in the New Testament that Jesus is the Messiah, sent by God to be our deliverer, our Savior. Our application first is to be aware of the false prophets. Today, with the internet and with TV, we have in books just an incredible opportunity to hear a lot of different voices, a lot of ones who claim to be teaching God's truth. It takes real discernment. To tell the false, the counterfeit, from the truth. Sometimes it's obvious, sometimes it's not so obvious, but look and say, what's their attitude toward authority? Do they disregard holiness? Do they tout Christian liberty in such a way that it leads away from holiness? Are they greedy? Have they turned their backs on the message of the New Testament that has been held to for 2,000 years? Are they wanting something new? For those who do, their destruction is certain. And second, be sure that you fled to Christ. The only way of salvation is by going to Christ and trusting Him alone for your salvation. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we look and we see these warnings about the false teachers. And they've always been a part of the church. Those who would want to water down the message or change it, or who just turn away from the truth. Give us the spiritual maturity that we would not listen to them, to be able to discern when they're wrong. When they are talking out of ignorance rather than what they would suppose would be a superior knowledge. Help us each one to flee to Christ, to be trusting in Him, to continually trust in Him alone.